Thank you all for coming. Is this too loud? I might start talking louder even. The talk that I'm going to do is based largely on a text that I wrote in Spanish, which I unfortunately don't have here with me to distribute because it's still at the printers, because in Spain everything always happens mañana. And that text is in turn based on a lot of other things that have been written and said, which I'm not going to refer to directly, because I think it's much more interesting when books just serve as sort of temporary repositories that eventually work their way into the stories that we tell each other. But just to point that out there, that pretty much nothing that I'm going to say is terribly new. And I often have a habit of speaking too fast. So if I do that, or if I say something that doesn't make sense, or use something from the American idiom like diminishing returns or other phrases that that may perhaps become central to what I'm trying to say that people don't understand, please, please interrupt me and ask for an explanation. And is there anyone here die in vertaling wil? Die geen de Engels niet goed begrijpt. Okay, good. Yes. So I'm going to try to accomplish a few different things in the next hour and a half. Does the very next talk start right at 2? Anyone know? No? There's a little bit of margin? Okay. So I'm going to try to accomplish a few things in the next hour and a half, and I'm just going to... that's kind of dangerous. And distribute some of those things throughout this room to help me remember, and just that they stay here and stay present to the conversation. The first will be I want to demolish Marxism, or at least chip away at its foundations. So that'll go here. The second is I'm going to make an unexpected and perhaps irrelevant contribution to anti-Deutsch theory. The third is... I'm going to prove that magic exists. Let's leave that right here in the middle. It's an interesting one. And then finally, I'm going to argue the hypothesis that anti-capitalist workers' movements were defeated in a battle that took place on another planet, and that the greatest nemesis and also the only hope of these movements were witches. Witches. Hexen, yeah. And then maybe like a couple of like continuous points that actually make a little bit of sense, unlike these things that I've just said, which I'd like to sort of maybe hope that people take away with them. Oh no, don't eat the magic. Is that capitalism is a counterinsurgency strategy, and the creation of the new communes occurs in the shadows of the new prisons. So... does anyone have a watch that they could lend me? So try not to run over. Oh, thank you very much. Oh, geez, we're late. I would like to start this talk off out by saying, by talking about in the beginning. Unfortunately, the beginnings are lost to us. And secondly, there are many different beginnings. There are many different, rather independent trajectories of state formation, of the creation of states. And all of them are quite a bit different. Now, some of them perhaps never would have arrived at what we have today. For example, state formation in South America was probably doomed to limited accomplishments at best, because the state-forming areas were always surrounded by very, very strong anti-authoritarian cultures with a proven ability of military superiority to sort of keep them confined to the Andean highlands. Other places, for example, like China, probably would have developed something pretty similar, although in the aesthetics of it quite different to what we have now, given just like a couple more centuries. They were even developing their own, you know, their own sciences to that effect, sort of a Confucian science as opposed to like a Baconian science, or science based on the philosophies of Francis Bacon. Yes. Baconian as in Francis Bacon, as in The sort of the specific scientific mythology that can be expressed in the ideas of reproducibility and experiment, the so-called scientific method, the sort of objectively presented scientific method. I'll get to that when I talk about magic. There's a few things that I don't really have time to argue now, but I just want you all to trust me that like it's been pretty well empirically established. But that's just a little bit about state formation that's sort of that's kind of a tangential topic or like a side topic that we don't have enough time to go into now. But basically, the various deterministic theories for state formation have pretty much all been widely discredited. The ideas that which are, for example, often fairly common among either Marxists or, on the other hand, anarcho-primitivists, that there are certain economic factors or geographical factors that cause states to form or that determine state formation. There's now a wealth of historical and ethnographic data that shows that there's no single path towards state formation, and that it's also not a unilineal history, that more states have started to form and then fallen apart due to their own ineptitudes or been overthrown by their own subjects and neighbors than states that have actually successfully established themselves. So, for example, agriculture and sedentary agriculture, sorry, and cities do not cause state formation. They are a necessary precondition, but that's a very different thing to talk about preconditions and causation, because there are many, many societies that have existed with sedentary agriculture or in cities that have not formed states, or, for example, societies that have set up, for example, complex infrastructure, like complex irrigation works without a state, and then a state developed, and then they overthrew the state, and they kept their same economic mode, they kept the irrigation works and all of that without need of the state formation. So the state formation is something that maybe can arise out of this or can be laid atop of this, but there's not like a unilineal progression of A, then B, and then C. That would be like a topic for its own talk, so I can't quite go into that.
Yeah, what do you mean exactly by state? What's your definition of state?
Uh-huh. A state would be a bureaucratic array of institutions that govern society and that move towards the monopolization of decision-making and the monopolization of coercive force. But it's an array of institutions that also includes the capacity for coercive force and is a project basically of from an anarchist perspective, a project of social control. One could also say a project of expropriating parts of economic surplus to support a specialized elite, and also organizing economic and social and political life of a society. Okay, so basically, like I said, the beginnings have sort of been lost to us. We don't really know how it was back then, but we do know a couple things that, for example, totally refute Engels' idea of why the state formed, and that also totally refute your basic or more common primitivist conceptions of why the state formed. That it wasn't quite so simple as just this caused that. Like either that, like Engels argues that economic classes, the conflict from economic classes, required a state to form, or that a primitivist might argue that sedentary agriculture and cities caused the state to form. So states have formed, so now they're something that we have to deal with, and so one thing that we can do is look back. So we could say that in the beginning there were the Romans, and then the Romans fell, and then in this particular part of the world, known as Europe, you had a sort of interesting situation. You had at that point what I would argue was a relatively weak patriarchy compared to what came before it and what came after it. That in the Roman system, patriarchy as a sort of a strategy or broad institution, or rather philosophy to various institutions for hierarchical control, was quite a bit stronger. And then also later, around the Enlightenment and the Renaissance and all that to the present day, patriarchy has been a lot stronger, because you had a situation in which you had like a fairly unified empire that collapsed at a time of great population movement. All these different societies and nations moving into Europe that all had sort of different ways of organizing, and most of them had different kinds of patriarchies that weren't necessarily intelligible to each other. So that kind of broke it down to a sort of lowest common denominator patriarchy, which was quite a bit weaker. And that for capitalism to arise had to really be strengthened, and I think I'll get to that later. So basically, often when people think about the beginnings of capitalism, or in Foucauldian terms, the beginning of biopower, they tend to think about a period in history much more recent than what, like, a lot of people, for example, preeminent among them, Silvia Federici, has argued is too late, that these developments started a lot earlier. So we could talk about biopower as a sort of basically when power becomes productive, right? Or when Foucault tended not to like to talk about the state, but I do. So when the state becomes productive, and now this is just a shift of degree, really, because in its beginnings the state tends to be more parasitical, that it's not contributing very much to the equation, but rather it tends to attach itself to societies and maybe enforce legibility, enforce these societies to produce in a way that's easy for them to capture part of the surplus, but that isn't really quite creating a positive sum game. And at a certain point, power becomes productive, that instead of just taking the surplus, it begins to engineer every aspect of social life so that more and more power is being produced, more and more, that basically production is basically becomes like the ruling ideology. So not just people meeting their needs and having to make a little bit more so that the state can live off of some, but everything that we do being geared towards sort of a society-wide factory-like apparatus that is based in multiplication, in accumulation, in growth. And that happened in a lot of different ways, that process of moving from like a primarily parasitical state to a primarily productive state. And I'm going to get to that later also, because first I wanted to talk a little bit about this period when the Roman Empire had collapsed, and you had lots of different polities, and lots of different nations, and a great many of them were not states. Kropotkin actually talks about certain of these societies in this period as sort of these sort of peasant utopias. He talks about these communes, and maybe he exaggerated a bit, but there's a certain amount of truth to that, and at the very least a great deal of imaginary truth to that idea of these peasant communes during this period before strong states emerged again. So I'm going to talk briefly about the Germans, and I'm going to talk about actually the German ethnicity as a state-forming technology. First, let me explain some of the basis to that ethnicities can be looked at in a way as a political strategy, right? In lots of periods of history and in lots of parts of the world, ethnicities have been so frequently shifting that even in just the time span of one generation, ethnicity was often a matter of choice. And that throughout much of the history of the world, it's the history of, the history of the recent world, you know, just like the last couple thousand years, is the history of states trying to dominate surrounding peoples. I'm going to get to that. I'm not going to offer a precise definition of ethnicity, I'm going to explain how it's a matter of choice. So throughout a lot of the history of the world, it's been a history of states trying to dominate larger and larger populations, and many of these people trying to flee or avoid or prevent that process. And now I can't remember who said it, but there's this quote that's really interesting. Ethnicity begins where sovereignty ends. In the Roman Empire, also with the Greek city-states, the barbarians were always the ones who were outside of state power. It didn't matter what language they spoke. If they spoke the same language, they would still be barbarians if they were outside of state power. It didn't matter if they were nomadic or sedentary, if they also practiced sedentary agriculture, because if they did, but they were outside of state power, they were also considered barbarians. So this very, very common discursive tool that's been used from China to Europe throughout history, that of the barbarians and the civilized, or in other idioms, the raw and the cooked, is basically something that all it really communicates is whether or not these are state subjects. So this is kind of like a highfalutin way of saying, highfalutin is American for like, yeehaw. This is like a grandiose way of validating state subjects and saying people who are slaves of the state are wonderful and much better off and more culturally enlightened. And the barbarians are the people who are outside of that. Where was I going with this? Yes. So a lot of these different ethnicities, these ethnic names, these different ethnic groups were actually sort of created in a way by these state centers to define these exterior peoples. Because definition, of course, is a necessary first step towards domination. Now when they did this, a lot of these different ethnicities, even though this is later masked in questions of blood and history, in terms of the individuals, they had a lot of choice involved, whether they wanted to run for the hills or stay in the valleys and pay taxes and perform corvée labor and go off to war when the state said that they had to go off to war. So especially in certain regions of the world, this has been like a choice that every single generation has faced. Do I become a barbarian of whatever name, whether it's the Miao in China or say the gypsies in Europe or the Berber in Northern Africa, or do I stay civilized? Do I stay Han Chinese, or do I stay Prussian, or do I stay Algerian? Of course, at that point didn't exist. Arabic and Muslim, yes.
Sorry, I just think that there's a lot of people that do not have a choice. It's not about like you choose to be civilized or you choose to be barbarian in your terms, but I think that the system puts a lot of the regions of the world in a position where you cannot choose.
No, absolutely. I preface that by saying that this has been true during certain times of history and in certain parts of the world. And of course not. Yeah. It's absolutely not linear. And it's easy for us to think of ethnicity as something that's static in time because in Europe for so long and in much of the world for so long, all the areas have been closed in, everyone exists within borders, and all of these national identities are enforced in one way or another, and competing national identities are suppressed. So that choice is generally not so common in the world, but through in many parts of the world, it's still, and a few parts of the world, it still is, and at many times throughout world history, it has been. So at this point, when we talk about ethnicities as a political strategy, for most of us, it's a political strategy that we no longer choose, but one that we're born into. Now, the Germans would be just one of many different ethnicities that are a state forming technology that basically. A wide hodgepodge of people moved into what is now considered to be Europe due to various population pressures before and during the collapse of the Roman Empire. And these people probably themselves didn't consider themselves any more part of one single group than, say, Brazilians do with Italians, just because there may be some linguistic similarities between them. But the Romans assigned all of these peoples the term the Germans, I don't think that's exactly how they phrased it, but you get the point. A lot of these different societies had basically patriarchal forms of organization, and they also there was a lot of influence in chieftains who were often elected, often chosen, but chieftains who served as sort of war leaders and sort of made federations or unions between them. So you basically had you didn't have a state among them, but you had a culture that was perhaps sympathetic to the state project. Whereas in plenty of other societies, you also had this position of like chieftains who would serve as war leaders, but within an anti-authoritarian culture, this never manifested as a drive towards creating a state, but in fact manifested as a rejection of the state. One example of that, for example, would be the Mapuche, who have their taki, their war leaders, but then they also have a very anti-authoritarian culture that has generally rejected both the internal creation of the state and also the external imposition of the state. And a little point that I forgot to mention earlier is that there's many, many examples of societies, including societies that practice sedentary agriculture, in which a state never internally emerged, and the only factor of differentiation that could possibly explain that is that there was a cultural determination within that society to never let a state emerge. Basically, an anti-authoritarian culture was in many societies enough to prevent a state from emerging over thousands of years until a far superior military technology could come in and impose that. And that right there turns Marxism on its head. So I'm going to take this one back. The idea that a everyone's looking very skeptical. The idea that an anti-authoritarian culture could determine economic modes of production and also political organizing strategies is basically a reversal of the traditional Marxist idea that the culture rather has to be a reflection of those economic modes of production, which is also what Engels argued in his. Hypothesis of state formation. Where were we? The Germans. So basically,
is that like only the what as you refer to Marxism, like the state theory or also the economic theory? Are they linked? Like you say, like you say with that, you know, you disband the arguments.
Yeah, no, I was definitely exceeding myself and exaggerating when I said I would demolish Marxism, but probably just like chipping away at some of the foundations. But those foundations being this sort of material determinism and also the theory, their theories of state formation. My understanding is that, well, for example, specifically what Engels wrote about state formation wasn't written in the 60s, and that also, for example, in the what is it, how is it translated, what Marx wrote about, like his essay about the German ideology, also sort of establishes this this need for cultural forms to correspond to this sort of economic substructure. But so my understanding is that didn't actually arise in the 60s. I was parroting.
Everyone that adheres to Marxist state theory would never go back to Engels and see him as the only kind of source for looking at the state in a Marxist way, because there were much more substantial theories that were actually really starting only to engage and conceptualize the state in the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
I think it's very important to go back to the very rudimentary interpretations of Engels.
Okay, but not just Engels, but also things that Marx specifically wrote. But if you wish, I can retract that and say that I'd wish to demolish or at least chip away at the idea of material determinism, if that is more acceptable. But anyways, I disagree with you that I'm only referring to one obscure thing that Engels wrote, and I think this is something that obviously many Marxism is a complex body and many Marxists don't adhere to, but I think this is something that and Marxism itself, in terms of just what the man himself wrote, is sort of a heterogeneous body of thought. But I think there's it's sort of like the Bible anyways, you know, anyone can find whatever they want, but there's plenty in there to justify that reading. But anyways, the Germans, thank you. Oh man, we're never going to finish. So the Germans. So anyways, the Germans as a sort of a potentially hierarchical society that came into contact with the Romans and were to a certain extent defined by the Romans as such, rather than responding to Roman attempts to dominate them through rejection, responded more through mimicry. So, for example, the great barbarians who defeated defeated the Romans and sacked Rome and all that, many of them had actually received their training in the legions, and many of them were trying to replicate the Roman project. And this sort of defines a large part of the characterizes a large part of European history after the fall of the Roman Empire, in which, as I mentioned, the structures of governance were much weaker because of the collapse of the Roman Empire, also largely because of the collapse of like a coherent and extremely hierarchical system of patriarchy into a more sort of like lowest common denominator form. There's like an interesting story, for example, in the history of Berlin, that like before the city was founded, or when there were like, you know, sort of smaller settlements there, the populations of that area were predominantly what's, you know, now referred to as Slavic, and also at times, like, you know, specifically referred to as Venden, and you had a small elite that was basically defining itself as German, that had that language and had these cultural practices, which sort of served as sort of a guidebook for how to form a state. based on a lot of learning from the Roman model. That was like a lot of influence from the Roman Empire. For example, you also see this in the fact that what was essentially a Germanic empire termed itself the Holy Roman Empire. So they saw themselves as the sort of torchbearers of this great civilization. And within their social organization, there were sort of encoded forms of how to establish state forms. And a lot of these different military German tribes sort of went around and conquered the local populations and sort of inserted themselves on top of these local populations as sort of a parasitical proto-state. Now, in the area where Berlin was eventually founded, you had like predominantly Slavic inhabitants that had like an overall rather horizontal social structure and a mobile military German nobility came and conquered them and began the project of state formation on that area and also of city building. And there was actually, I can't remember what year, but it was around 1000 AD. There was a major revolt. And also part of that was imposing Christianity because like salvation religions tend to be a very common pattern in state formation across the world, no matter what continent you look at. And so that even though the original Christians were sort of, you know, lowly lion fighters and things of that nature, at a certain point, Christianity got co-opted and turned into a very powerful recuperating and unifying strategy by the Roman elite. And this itself was adopted by the subsequent German elite. So they imposed Christianity on this population. They took them over. There was a huge revolt. And they killed off all the nobility and the priests and kicked them out. And there were during the whole Middle Ages, there were many revolts of this nature of like people rising up and killing and burning the nobility and the priests and burning down the castles. It was very, very beautiful, sort of early illegalism, perhaps. And for about 150 to 200 years, this whole region in the center of Europe was pagan, was relatively horizontally organized, was communal. Economically, and they had to wage a crusade against it. One of the earliest crusades actually was the I think in English it would be referred to as the Vendan Crusade, was waged against them to sort of re-civilize them and reconquer them. So that really has nothing to do with anti-Deutsch, but it's a sort of yeah, I was being provocative basically, but like throwing that in there of like understanding the German ethnicity as a state-making technology, which doesn't at all make them unique because there's many other ethnicities around throughout world history that have served that function, but it's an interesting way to look at ethnicity as a political strategy, which for most people is not at all chosen but imposed, but at times throughout the world has been chosen, and that also could reflect interestingly on the whole sort of squatter or anarchist identity or ghetto as a sort of feeble attempt to choose an anti-authoritarian urban tribe. Yes. So, so I wanted to argue that that capitalism is a counterinsurgency strategy, and I don't want to establish this as the new doctrine. Just to put this out there, you know, I think this is an interesting way to look at it. I think it's also a very useful way to look at it, and I think it's a way that is largely true. And I'm directly posing this sort of as a counter to what tends to be the dogma that looks at the state arising as something to sort of protect the bourgeoisie, ensure the ability of capitalists to profit, and all of that. And I disagree with that way of looking at things, and I think it sort of needs to be turned around. There's two interesting famines. In the first in European history and the second in world history that bear consideration. Not famines, but population crises. The first happened around directly as a result of the Black Plague in Europe, 1300s, mid-1300s. Europe lost a third of its population. The interesting thing about what this did is that it meant there was a lot of empty lands, and it meant that there was very little labor for the elite. They had like a labor scarcity because of this. There were fewer people who could do the work that they wanted to get done, and meanwhile, if they tried to ride their serfs too hard, there was plenty of empty lands that the serfs could move off to and set up these communes, some of which Kropotkin would later write about. So this created a huge crisis among the European elite, and it also like, for example, there's you can look at like wages, like real wages during this time, like shot up like three times as high as they were before. And it's also important to point out that at this point, money was not what money is today. That at that point, money was essentially a token of exchange. And I mean, it's become so convoluted that it would be sort of hard to define exactly what it is today. But what it is not is a simple statement of value or exchange, that this much coin equals that much food or whatever. So that, like, the for example, inflation, which is sort of a fundamental part of capitalism, took off largely after this. And it's also important to note that in this time period, people, like, measured in a sort of, like, regular people, measured in a sort of real, meaningful way, were a lot better off than they were in the following centuries. That they ate a lot better, they had, you know, much, you know, better access to food and their needs and all that. And the sort of, like, image of starvation from the Middle Ages is actually more associated with the very late Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance, which is the period when capitalism, in its most fundamental forms, was really developing. So at about this time is when you see the process, and it's very earliest, the process of enclosures begin. The process also of privatization of land. Around this time is when you see the feudal elite begin to bring back Roman law. Typically, people understand, like, you know, history as being like a sort of progression, but in fact, there was sort of a big dip there for a while. That land during the feudal era was a trust. It was collectively owned, and it was considered to be a trust between the elite and the peasants. Roman law, however, allowed land to be bought and sold. It allowed land to be a commodity. And so the feudal elite began to try to bring back Roman law, and a lot of times they had to do that through force, because bringing back Roman law meant that they would be the property owners. That meant that they had to dispossess the serfs and turn the serfs into dependent wage workers, when under feudalism they were codependent. The serfs and the landlords, and of course they had an antagonistic relationship. Their codependency was not any sort of, you know, happy copacetic cooperation, but they were fairly well matched in terms of their collective power, and that those centuries was like a constant story of, like, you know, one side trying to win a little bit more of the pie, the other side pushing back and trying to win a little bit more of the pie, and if one side pushed too much, then they would go and burn them down and, like, burn their castles, and if the other side pushed too much, then, like, they would declare a crusade on them and slaughter them all. So basically, this was sort of what could be seen as not the beginning, because there really is no beginning, but an intensification of the process to expropriate the peasants, kick people off of the land, sever people's ties with the land, and entirely change the rules of the game. And this increased the sort of pressure in the pressure cooker. It increased the antagonism between these different classes, and this blew up, among several other occasions, in the German Peasant Rebellion, which, with the ideology of Anabaptism, which has some interesting parallels with anarchism, hundreds of thousands of mostly German-speaking peasants rose up and kicked off or killed many, many aristocrats, feudal landlords, priests, bishops, and all the rest, and declared a commune on earth. Declared a commune on earth. And they had some rather shady allies in all of this. These allies tended to be city dwellers, and they tended not to work with their own hands. They weren't like the craftspeople in the cities, but they were people who maybe specialized in buying and selling these crafts and the agricultural products and that. They also saw them that they had a conflict with the aristocratic elite, but at a certain point they abandoned this whole struggle, sold it out, and sided with these sort of emerging German princes, and that was sort of like one of the first cases where you see, you know, this age-old pattern of reformists stabbing revolutionaries in the back, and that was the Protestant Reformation. to Protestantism as a sort of a reform strategy, which allowed the emerging bourgeoisie to destabilize the old power structure to allow for their own ascendancy, and to create an even deeper defeat for the peasants. So that was a time when these enclosures really started, when peasants started being kicked off their land, when lending became such an important institution that money transformed into something entirely different, that money was no longer just a simple symbol of exchange and became a form of productivity and power in its own right. For a while, the whole lending system, they really had to work out all these problems in it, because all these states kept running up debts that they couldn't pay in order to pay these mercenary armies, which they needed to kill off their peasants when they rose up. And that actually, anti-Semitism played a major role in that, because for a time that was sort of the basic strategy. They would take out loans from a whole variety of bankers, and then at times when their debts were too high, they would decrease these debts by expropriating the Jewish bankers and using when the Jewish bankers were only obviously a portion of the bankers, and then use these sort of like these proto ill-formed anti-capitalist sentiments to win popular approval for these pogroms, and also, you know, get themselves a great deal of money. Now, this wasn't sustainable. In time, they had to... This was as they were really transitioning from a primarily parasitic state to a productive state. And you could see that they weren't yet able to do it, because they needed all these loans to pay the armies to carry out the repression, because the repression in that time period increased. It skyrocketed because they were changing the rules of the game, and they were kicking people off of the land and claiming so much more than had ever been legitimate for them to claim. But they couldn't yet create enough economic activity which they could then expropriate a part of or tax to pay for this repression. So they could only do this through the institution of anti-Semitism, of expropriating bankers. Eventually they ran out of lots of, like, for example, Spain, you know, kicked out all their Jewish population. Many other countries did this, and they couldn't do the same thing to non-Jewish bankers, because that would violate the fundamental rules of the game. That would violate this sort of consensus between the different factions of the elite, and they needed to be working together in order to achieve this this great big shift that they were pulling off. So, for example, the Fuggers at the time were like the most powerful bankers in the world. They were Christian bankers, and they couldn't just be simply expropriated, because that would sort of, because they were united in this joint Christian ideology. Christianity, by the way, sort of being the prototype for whiteness as a way for elites to communicate a fundamental commonality of interests. So the Fuggers and the Holy Roman Empire crashed together. They fell together. Their fortunes were linked, and they both fell. Now, the answer to this need for increased productive capacity, increased wealth, and increased repression was found largely through colonization of the Americas, of Africa, the slave trade, the silver and gold mines in South America, and then eventually the plantation economy. So a lot of these founding elements of capitalism are found in the necessity of like this state, which was transitioning to a modern state, in its necessity to maintain social control, in its desperate fight to not be overthrown in all of these peasant rebellions, that as they were upping the ante, they faced a huge increase in resistance, in violent resistance. So thousands of them, we burned thousands of them to death. We threw down hundreds of their castles, and in order to survive as an elite class, they had to go into overdrive. They had to create an entirely new system that could produce, as it were, produce power out of thin air to enable them all these new capacities that they needed in order to survive. Because what you've seen in all these other places throughout the world is that states have risen and they've been overthrown by their own subjects and by their own neighbors, because states are a fucking pain in the ass. Everybody here knows this, and this hasn't changed in the last 1,000 years. Anarchism, doesn't have a whole lot that's terribly new. So basically, the elites, in a sort of concerted strategy, had to institute the foundations of capitalism in order to survive as a counterinsurgency strategy. So they started instituting wage labor, not as just something that peasants did on the side, on top of their sort of a relatively self-sufficient existence in order to win like a little bit more exchange value to get some things from somewhere else, but turning wage labor into an institution of absolute dependency and increased exploitation, and they also. Sort of launched this whole wave of primitive accumulation or turning land into a commodity and cutting people's relationship with the land. And then also this whole wave of colonialism around the world. And it's important to, I mean, some people have, you know, this idea that, you know, first there was like feudalism and then mercantilism and then capitalism. But I think the fundamental changes were happening in that phase, which is often written off as mercantilism, which to me is primarily just a question of a different state strategy for how to manage the economy. That states are always managing economies. At times they can talk about more free markets. At times they can talk about less free markets. And now the plantation economies, it seems like, you know, very uncapitalist according to normal conceptions, because there wasn't wage labor going on, but this production in the colonies was the value produced was appropriated, was plugged back into capitalism, because the primary commodities that were being produced were basically the fuel of the new wage workers in Europe, right? So the sugar that suddenly made up a large part of their diet. And the tea, the rum that pacified them, the clothes, the cotton and the clothes that they wore, basically what sustained them, what replenished their labor power, was produced in the colonies. So even though it was produced in a way that was not directly based on wage labor, it was directly related to wage labor and to capitalism, because it was a necessity for it. It was plugged back in. And it's also important to recognize that the same damn thing is going on. Capitalism never has and never will probably exist without blatant slave labor. There's more slaves in the world now than there ever were, and this isn't happening in some, you know, forgotten corner of the world, but it's happening at the beginning of important productive processes that result in the commodities that arrive to markets in Europe and North America. This isn't something external to capitalism, it's something incredibly fundamental to capitalism. A very similar thing happened to women's position in society, that in the early and middle ages, women participated in pretty much every single office or profession that men did, and they insofar as land was owned or adhered to communities, women also had direct access to land. They could inherit and pass on personal effects and property, also, although not necessarily property in the capitalist sense, because that hadn't existed yet. And they had a great level of influence in these communities and in all of these major rebellions, in all these heretical sects, for example, the Tabors in what's now, I believe, Czech Republic, that area, Bohemia, and the Cathars in southern France. These were huge, great rebellions against Christianity, against developing state forms, that had women and men fighting together. So basically at this point, patriarchy didn't exist as an institution strong enough to divide the oppressed in half and make one half spend most of its energies dominating and oppressing the other half. They could fight side by side. And this need to strengthen patriarchy was a hugely important part in the development of capitalism and the development of the state. Insofar as that regards capitalism, women's roles were limited, we can say, to more specific tasks that were then placed on a value hierarchy below male tasks. So the men at certain points, although often, of course, even though it was always portrayed as atypical, often women were the ones entering into the workshops and factories, but typically wage labor was for men, and then women's labor had to go to support men. So women's labor thus was like a complement, was similar to this invisible slave labor that was a necessary support to the more visible wage labor. So basically women's role, their assigned role in this early developing capitalism, was to reproduce labor power, to take care of the men, to raise children, to make the clothes, to make the food, so that the wage workers could keep working. So this was what you refer to as like a hidden cost. That was a great deal of labor that was sort of naturalized. Oh, that's just what women do. Women cook and wash the dishes and raise the children. It's a natural activity, and that also, you know, hidden costs also allow employers to pay less, for example, because they're only paying for half of what they're actually using. There were also efforts, and these didn't just sort of evolve, you know, naturally on the basis of, you know, seeking out profit, but on many occasions they were directly imposed by the, like, the overarching political authorities of the time, whether those were the princes or the, you know, the families of nobles and elites in, like, the Italian city-states, that these arose as strategies. These didn't arise as sort of blind evolutions of accumulating profit and abstract value. So, for example, there were campaigns to increase sexism. In Italy, there were specific campaigns to encourage rape of single women. There was a huge amount, with the printing press especially, a huge amount of propaganda encouraging fear of women as witches and encouraging evoking like a male pride, you know, a male pride that, like, men, if they're not in charge, then they're weak and they're worthless. If they don't control their wives, then it's because they're absolutely useless. There was a huge amount of propaganda in this period enforcing these patriarchal values. And that was extremely necessary to capitalism. Now, one thing that you saw that was really interesting, in areas where there were peasant uprisings, that they would rise up against this new state of affairs, and also risings of, like, the early workers in the cities, like the skilled and unskilled laborers in the cities, also rose up with an early equivalent of an anti-capitalist and anti-state discourse. And they were often, you know, massacred. And as this was happening, of course, the state was trying to impose the notion that, you know, men were actors and women were passive supporters. So it was more typically the men in these cases who would be, you know, executed as the leaders and whatnot. In these same places, one generation later, is often where the heaviest witch hunts occurred. In the same places where there would be some, you know, an uprising in a community, a generation later they would come back and they would burn to death the old women as witches. And these old women were very often the friends, the accomplices, the comrades, the lovers, the family members of the men who were executed in these crushed peasant uprisings. In other words, these were the people who were passing on this historical memory of resistance. These were the ones who hadn't forgotten and who hadn't forgiven and were carrying on this this story of resistance, this memory of the communes, this memory of when we had a connection to the land, this memory of when land wasn't a commodity, and this memory of the times when we threw the prince out of his tower, and when we cut off the head of the priest. And so these same women were demonized as the witches, and the connection with the past was severed in this way through an extreme violence that killed easily over a million people in the span of a couple centuries throughout Europe. And this violence was happening simultaneously with the genocide in the Americas, often with the same tactics, that they would develop tactics in a plantation in South America, and then they would write a report about it, either through church officials or through property owners, and they would read it back in Europe, or vice versa. And it was, you know, written in the languages of the time, but they would talk about the witch hunts that they did. They would talk about, you know, the practices that the pagans are using. And often these practices centered around meetings. They centered around the forming of new collective spaces in an illegal way at night. And this was sort of masked in this rhetoric of demonism and witchcraft. And what are they doing in these spaces? Well, they invented, you know, the most delegitimizing thing that they could think of. You know, nowadays it's you know, terrorist objectives. In those days it was, you know, to kiss Satan's asshole and to sacrifice children to Satan. Children, that's another very important thing, is that at this time, in this time period, contraception and abortion were heavily criminalized, including punished with the death penalty. Whereas before, they had been generally tolerated and preached against, but usually not repressed, and certainly generally not repressed with the death penalty. This is largely starting in church campaigns in the 1300s after the Black Plague, and then intensifying that the 1400s and 1500s. That by the 1600s, it was. Yeah. It was pretty much all societies that I've ever heard about have had that aren't extremely patriarchal. People who can have babies tend to be the ones who self-organize their own reproduction. And that power was taken away because I forgot to mention this other population crisis, the second population crisis. the state realized, because we are basically the greatest wealth of the state, right? It's us. It's not gold, it's not trees, it's not oil, because that shit stays in the ground without us. So so the state has always faced this problem that when we rise up, you know, it's kind of problematic if they kill us, because then they're getting poorer. So the state use of annihilatory violence has always existed as an educational method to everyone else. Strike one to educate 100, to borrow a phrase from Lenin. So in this first population crisis, that resulted in a major loss of elite power and a major crisis for them. Then, not so long later, I think the end of the 1500s, but it could be the beginning of the 1600s, there was another population crisis, and this actually resulted in a global economic crisis, because it happened in the Americas and in Europe. In the Americas, generally there was a loss of about 2/3 of the population due to genocidal practices, and in Europe, because of this increasing poverty, because starvation was sort of imposed on the European peasantry as they were made to work harder and harder, what's now Germany lost 1/3 of their population in this time. This was happening at the same time on both sides. Because they thought when they came to the Americas they had found like a limitless population of slaves, and they decimated it pretty rapidly by the way that they treated them. And so there was like this big discourse of against women who were sabotaging the reproductive machinery. Like this discourse against sabotage was used a lot in one of the earlier instances, before there were factories, against women, because women were being turned into sort of the proto factories. And so there were all these accusations of women sabotaging the reproduction of the nation, the reproduction of the wealth of these lords. So that power had to be taken away from them. Which that was one of the impulses of the development of Western science, was the need to produce demographic information, and also the need to take away from women and locate in specialized state-controlled institutions the ability to reproduce the population through primarily male doctors. And so in this second population crisis, it's totally different from the first population crisis, because the second one only actually leads to an increase in state power. It doesn't provide a crisis of rule. It creates an economic crisis, but not a crisis of rule. And that shows that in those intervening centuries, the state had inaugurated what really deserved to be called the earliest forms of biopower, that they were already taking over the sort of regimentation of life, and they had definitely removed the independence of the lower population. So if you remember, the first population crisis provoked a crisis of rule, because the lower classes still had some possibility of independence, that they could move to these other lands and set up these communes. And by the second population crisis, that wasn't possible at all. So even though it provoked an economic crisis, it was not at all a high point in resistance struggles. It was very much very, very dark days. Maybe it's time to talk about magic. So I think I've sort of come up to a certain point of like looking at some of the pressures that led to the development of capitalism, and not understanding capitalism as sort of just like this need for more profit and like this unilineal progressive growth, but rather as a largely intentional strategy that was implemented through like a simultaneous communication of repressive tactics between the Americas and Europe, a need to rupture, to break people's connection with the past, people's connections with the land, to also create this Christian and then later this white identity, to try to create a sort of a false commonality of interests between the rulers and one class of the ruled. Magic. Okay. So everybody here knows that magic doesn't exist, that it's all just like smoke and mirrors. It's entirely absurd. Say, for example, let's take the example of a rain dance. If I were to do a little funny dance and it rained, which in Holland wouldn't be too improbable, then I could say, I did a dance to ask the clouds to rain, and it rained. and, you know, therefore magic exists. But then the scientists will come, the objective scientists will come and say, oh no, what we need to do is establish an effective method to test this hypothesis, because this hypothesis has to be reproducible. You have to be able to do this 100 times, and over the course of those 100 times that you do the rain dance and ask the clouds to bring down rain, there has to be an increase in the probability of rain. That say, if on any given day in the Netherlands it only has a 90% chance of rain, with on the days that you do your rain dance, there has to be a 95% chance of rain or 100% chance of rain, right? So this is reproducibility. This is the scientific method. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot useful about the scientific method. I absolutely despise relativism, of this idea that, you know, well, it's all just opinions and points of views and you can't really know anything, because that perspective is very, very useful to power, because it allows the confirmation and the production of facts to remain with specialists, and requires us to just sort of, you know, it's necessary to democratic governance. It allows everyone to have their opinions and no one to act on them, because there's no possibility for us to arrive at an external legitimacy for these opinions. You know, I'm taking this course of action because it's right, because I can tell that it's right, because I know that this is the way that the world is, and I don't give a shit what you tell me. No, you just have an opinion. Well, that's your opinion, but these people, you know, the bankers, they have another opinion, and they respect your opinion, but you have to respect theirs. So yeah, I totally despise relativism. But so I do think there are things useful to the scientific method. However, science has its own mythologies. Western science took the place of Christianity as the dominant religion. And so there's a sort of a little trick that's being played here on this demand for reproducibility. And that is the mythic value of reproducibility itself. Why the fuck are we living in a world in which reproducibility is a necessary value? Well, in a capitalist world, that's actually not such a big surprise. We live in a world which is being increasingly converted into one big factory. So the only thing that's of interest to power, and because it's of interest to power, it has to be inculcated in the rest of us and be of interest to the rest of us, is reproducibility. So I don't think that I could do a rain dance, and I love to dance, but I don't think I could do a rain dance that would pass this test of reproducibility and bring down the rain. But this imposed method of looking at this question is making us ignore the real existence of magic. God, I must sound like a hippie right now. It's also kind of interesting to point out that so many societies outside of Western society have believed in magic. Were they just all like completely full of shit? How could so many societies be so stupid to believe for millions of years in this thing that never gave them any results? And it wasn't until someone came along and said, "Oh no, you have to make an experiment and you know, pass the test of reproducibility." And they're like, "Oh shit, it doesn't work after all." You know, that's kind of a suspicious idea that really should be interrogated. Something else is going on when we do a rain dance. We are entering into dialogue with the world around us, and instead of operating on a logic of reproducibility and of exploitation, in which we demand something, we need rain because we have crops to grow, because we have to sell them at the market, and blah, 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 we're entering into a dialogue with the world around us, and we are, instead of creating a logic of reproducibility, creating a logic of mutuality. And mutuality is one thing that capitalism can never allow. It would, in fact, prefer that the question never even arise, which is why this objective scientific mythology of reproducibility, that's like, you know, the first response, is very useful, because it hides this other question of what's being accomplished. So if I do a rain dance, taking the example of rain, and the rain comes, then, you know, then this is good. We have a mutuality of interest between us and the world, and you know, our crops will grow, and this is wonderful. If the rains don't come, this isn't a sign that, you know, my magic trick failed. Here I should point out that there are many different paradigms of magic, and in fact, some paradigms of magic have existed without this idea of mutuality, so I shouldn't homogenize at all. There, in fact, like alchemy and many versions of like Renaissance era magic in Europe had many of the same basic ideas of science, of Western science, but just a different method. So I'm talking about one specific paradigm of magic. If the rain doesn't come, then that means there's an imbalance here. That means that maybe I'm doing something wrong, that I haven't given enough to the world in order to deserve this rain. Now, what you see over a long period of time is maybe my rain dances don't make the rain come more often, but I am constantly engaged in a dialogue with the natural world, and I'm constantly reproducing a culture based on the idea of mutuality between me and the world. in this context, I am much less likely to cut down all of the trees, to destroy the land, and to pump all of these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And now actually what you're seeing in certain parts of the world is that in fact the rains are no longer coming, and you could make an argument that this is in fact because people on a global scale have stopped doing rain dances, that people have completely exited from a mentality of mutuality and gone towards a logic of reproducibility and of exploitation. So it's maybe not necessarily the, and this is of course, I can't help but argue this the way that I've been trained, very, you know, rationally and logically, and still demonstrating, ironically enough, a quid pro quo in this relationship. But you know, it's hard to escape one's birth. That you still see this result. That in the end, it can be said that the rain dance does make sure that the rains will come. Because if the rains don't come and you're engaged in a dialogue with the natural world, then you're going to look in your own behavior about what you can give to make sure that that balance still exists. And if you exit out from that and demand a logic of exploitation, that the natural world exists as a collection of resources for us to pillage, then you're going to create an environment in which there are more droughts, in which there's more starvation, in which the soils fail and the crops fail and people starve to death. So I cannot make this orange disappear, but presto changer, magic exists. I want to just to kind of de-romanticize magic a little bit, also give another example of early state formation in China when magic also existed and it accomplished something, but it accomplished something not quite so woo or heartwarming. So basically, Confucian ideology was important to state formation in China, and Confucian ideology in a lot of its manifestations was rather scientific, was rather rationalistic. And a glaring exception to this, for example, is the I Ching, the Book of Changes, which is a sort of a fortune-telling system. But an interesting thing is I'm drawing right now on a work from Richard Baum. Yeah, Richard Baum. Which there's an interesting thing that you notice in the I Ching and in this sort of mystical conception that was tolerated by Confucian rationalism of the sort of cosmos. And that is that the world of the gods in Han culture was almost an exact replica of Han Chinese bureaucracy. That you had a division of powers, you had a sort of flowchart of powers going down from the Jade Emperors down to different districts, and then down all the way to the local deities, and that a lot of the magical or religious rituals were in fact pretty much exactly the same as the bureaucratic rituals in terms of how to request things from the different deities, how to make protests about this isn't going so well, can you change things for us, and how to participate in this structure, how to lodge complaints, and all the rest. That to lodge a complaint to a god, you did it pretty much the same way as lodging a complaint to a high official. So what this magic act was accomplishing was in fact training people into a bureaucratic mentality, and training people to accept this bureaucracy by seeing it also reflected in the metaphysical organization of the world. And also to impugn a little bit our own rationality, is it any less of a magic trick when we, sign a petition or vote or file a complaint? That in a lot of ways this is the same sort of mythical structure. So yes. When do I need to finish? 2:00, I think. Criminy. Okay. Shit. Okay. In any case, if we run out of time, I'm sorry for like laying so many provocative statements on you. Some of them possibly total bullshit. Without opening time for discussion, for y'all to tell me how much bullshit this was. So like, I will make myself available for as long as need be outside once we have to vacate this room. But I kind of set myself too much provocative bullshit to say in an hour and a half. Who are you? You are
Mars.
The aliens, yes, perfect. Thank you. So the anti-capitalist workers' movements were defeated in a battle that took place on another world. I think simultaneous to all of these assaults that have been taking place on what we recognize as the real world, taking away from us our connection with the land, severing our contact with a history that's not narrated the way that they narrate it to us, taking away from communities their self-organization over their health and making babies and all that kind of thing, and also taking them out of this logic of mutuality, there was another offensive going on, and it's something that's been going on with an increasing strength much more recently, and I, for one, almost never hear anarchists talking about it, and it's a battle that we're losing and that we're barely even fighting, and this is the battle that's taking place in the imaginary world, or the world of the imaginary, which you could say is our connection between our present circumstances and our utopias. If you want a definition of the imaginary, and imagination being the capacity to access and to construct and to revitalize this connection, we were totally getting destroyed in the imaginary world, and we're not even talking about that loss. We're not even really so much fighting on that terrain, and a lot of times we're sort of not even aware of what's been lost. It's sort of like coded in small ways in our history. For example, the Paris Commune. Everyone here knows about the Paris Commune, probably, but the Paris Commune, in the name that it chose for itself, was a reference to this utopia of past centuries, of these peasants who, most of them probably, in all honesty, I mean, if we look at how humans operate and, you know, how things are today, most of them had probably never lived in a fully functioning commune. But and there probably wasn't ever this golden age of peasant communes throughout the Dark Ages, with maybe like a few complicated and partial exceptions. But at the very least, many of these peasants had a connection to this imaginary concept. That this was sort of their path towards their utopia, that they knew what they wanted and they had some practical experience with it in these communes, and this was remembered for a really long time. And when the Paris workers at that point rose up, they were making a reference to those past struggles, which were at that point largely being forgotten and that are even more forgotten today. May Day. People always say the first May Day in 1886, 1886. That wasn't the first May Day. The reason that the 1st of May was chosen as a day for this general strike, for the 8-hour workday in the United States, is that the German immigrant workers in the United States still remembered that this was a day of anti-authoritarian rebellion, that it was ritualized and tolerated as a holiday, but it was a day for mocking authority. It was a day for rising up against authority. And the night before it, Walpurgisnacht, Witch's Night, was mythically said to be the day, the night that all of the German the witches from around Europe would go and converge in the Brocken, in these mountains in central Germany, and that again is a reference to this practice of clandestine nighttime meetings during these centuries of resistance against developing capitalism and the emerging state, and it's a reference to this repression that was encoded as witch hunts, as a fight against witchcraft. So these days sort of survived as continuing rituals and memories of resistance to authority. And that's why that day was chosen for the general strike, for honestly a pretty fucking boring and self-defeating goal, an 8-hour workday. Like, they wanted to liberate themselves as workers. How is it possible to liberate yourself as a worker? What lack of imagination is necessary for you to confuse the revolution with a different workday? There is no revolution with a workday, and it's only possible to conceive of this kind of revolution if you've totally lost any connection with any way of things being different, with any past that kind of moves beyond that goes past the formations of capitalism in the state. And like I said in the beginning, that we don't have the beginnings. The beginnings are lost. So I'm not necessarily claiming that there was some mythical golden age, but what there is a sort of spotty continuity of practical experience with steps towards our utopias. And these have largely been lost, that we don't have any more utopias these days. And in fact, we have a rather stunning inability to conceive of utopias. And in fact, what there is and what there's been for a very long time, especially in the workers' movement, has been a very rationalistic and scientific replacement of... I always forget this. When you say of this for that, which one goes in the first position? The new thing or the old thing? Fuck. Sorry. Language problems. That there's been a replacement, a very scientific and rationalistic replacement of, of blueprints for utopias. That in order to grant themselves legitimacy, revolutionary movements need to publish their program or their pari-con or their mapped out framework of how society is going to function later. Who's going to do what? What do we do when things get out of hand? What do we do when there's conflicts? How will we solve the conflicts? Trying to fucking solve conflicts before they even arise, which basically means just avoiding and suppressing conflicts, which is terrible because people learn from conflicts, and that's why the state has always wanted to monopolize conflicts and to expropriate us from our own conflicts, because God forbid we might learn from them. So for the longest time, anti-capitalist movements have sort of focused on making blueprints in order to describe the future society, and thus to suppress the future society before it's even had a goddamn chance to be born. And now the sort of insurrectionary critique to this has at least minimized a lot of the damage of that, but without really, like, with totally missing the root of that problem. So generally, like, in anarchist circles today, you get lynched, or at the very least, you know, scorned with very, very superior and no doubt sexy sneers if you try to, like, you know, map out a blueprint for the future world, or say, you know, this is how an anti-capitalist society or an anarchist society would have to organize itself. And rightfully so, because that's you know, a terrible operation, I think. And those criticisms of you know, positing a blueprint are necessary. But this is an entirely different activity from the imaginary, from imagination, from imagining different futures, which is not coming up with answers, but it's rather exercising a very important muscle, which would become vital if we were to ever have an unlimited opportunity to organize our own lives. People on an individual scale or in a more collective scale can't organize their own lives if they don't have capacities for imagination, because then they're only reproducing what they're already trained in. And I know that the argument can be made and should be made that imaginaries are conditioned by what we know, by the values that have been instilled in us. But I would like to make the romantic argument that imaginations, if they're healthy and robust, also constitute an entirely unscientific possibility for parthenogenesis, for creation from out of nothing, for something entirely new, for something that comes from outside of the totality and can challenge the totality of what we know. And this ability has been largely discouraged. It's been largely infantilized, that the imagination is just something of children, and it's largely been lost for that reason. And at the same time that imagination has been infantilized, interestingly enough, all of these examples of other ways of living, other forms of social organization, have also been infantilized. Their memories have been infantilized, whereas the actual manifestations of them have been totally suppressed with genocide. So in the course of colonization, as a worldwide process, different forms of social organization were suppressed, and where those are remembered, largely through the ethnographic record, because anthropology had to arise in order to catalog everything that needed to be dominated and destroyed. Those examples are infantilized. So like, those societies have been destroyed in their physical manifestation, and then we can no longer make recourse to them as, like, an image of what another world might look like, because these are just primitive societies. Or, you know, well, this has nothing to do with today, because... because society is so much bigger today. And this is also in relation to, for example, societies that included millions of people and had high population densities. That doesn't matter. These are primitive societies. They have nothing to do with the future, and they have nothing to do with our present needs, even though social scale is a politically imposed choice. This can be seen on broad scale. This can also be seen within our own social movements. For example, the so-called Spanish Revolution, there it's been very obvious that political, that scale is an imposed choice, that you had these sort of pro-democracy activists from the beginning insisting that things be organized through a unitary structure based around a central assembly where everyone gets together and nothing can happen unless it has the approval of the overall assembly, and people who try to foment chaos and to allow like the multiplication of different and conflicting initiatives are suppressed or kicked out, or at least they attempt to do so. In Barcelona, fortunately, they weren't able to do that, chaos was able to flourish, and I think precisely for that reason, what happened in Barcelona was so much more interesting than the same occupations that happened in most other cities throughout Spain. There were constantly criticisms of this centralized assembly. There. Many people were constantly saying, no, we don't want to all pass through one assembly. This should be a meeting point where people share their ideas and not a necessary structure to give us a bureaucratic stamp of approval. Yes, you can go ahead and put up a tent now. Or yes, you can make that poster. Or yes, you can write that communique because we have given you the consensual legitimacy of this bigger body, which in reality is manipulated by a relatively small amount of people who have a lot of meeting skills and all that. Every time that we would make a proposal for decentralization, for letting entropy to do its messy work and just sort of break this into a sort of an ecosystem of different initiatives and groups constantly forming and reforming, the sort of consensus elite would make a counter proposal for more and better moderation. No, this whole thing will work, but we just need we need more moderating tools. We need more hand signals. And in fact, the anarchist proposal to decentralize the central assembly actually made it to a vote twice. And I don't really give a damn about majorities, but interestingly enough, it received overwhelming majority support both times. And both times, for some reason, the vote sort of disappeared. The first time on a technicality, and the second time because 40 people wanted more debate. Half of them, I think, were Trotskyists. And the rule had been passed that if more than 30 people want debate, it has to be debated. But because there's 10,000 people participating in this assembly, debate is impossible, so it has to go back to the commission. But it had already reached consensus in the commission, so there was no reason to go back and debate it there. So basically, the proposal to decentralize this assembly was defeated for the exact reasons that the proposal was made in the first place, because a centralized assembly is total absurd bullshit. And this could only exist because it was imposed. And that imposition was largely naturalized through a democratic discourse, but that democratic discourse was also heavily criticized, and people, the only way that they could keep doing what they were doing was to ignore those criticisms. So this whole idea of social scale being some natural thing. This society, there's 100 million people in it. We can't learn anything. We can't use decentralization. Why do you draw the lines around that 100 million people? You know, there's currently X number of people in the world. Where do you draw the lines? Why does it have to be around this bigger polity, and why can't it be around this network that's fragmented into much smaller, shifting practical groups and also individuals who are constantly existing in conflict with and outside of those groups, because I also don't think that there's ever going to be any society that's perfect and in which everyone feels free, because society also always exerts pressures towards conformity, and so it's also very important that there always be rebels, there always be people who are outside of that and perhaps even at war with that. But I, at the very least, would certainly prefer to live in a society in which there's no police and no banks and no state, and I mean, maybe this is just actually reveals weakness of my own personal character. But it would just be a lot more comfortable to be a rebel if you didn't have to worry about the possibility of prison. That it was just people would throw rotten eggs at you and say go away, we don't like your crazy talk here. We're living in utopia. You're ruining things for the rest of us. But anyways, utopias I think are not important as a sort of final solution. But they're important in terms of they represent an externality to this physical world and a sort of a dialogue between where we are now and where we want to be, and also an opportunity for us to exercise the imaginary, for us to exercise our capacities to imagine entirely different ways of living, which as hippie as it sounds, I think is incredibly important. And even talking with the blackest of the black insurrectionary anarchists, it seems to be a common problem that people run into again and again, is that when you finally have this chaotic, uncontrolled social meeting, the fact of like a lack of visions of how else it might be rises again and again as a problem and as a limitation. And so there needs to be, I think, a critical distinction made between visions and blueprints. And I think I'm going to end there because that may be the only practical thing that I've said in the last hour and a half. There's a little bit of time before 2 o'clock. And like I said, anyone who wants to continue arguing, we can move outside to continue doing that once we have to leave the room.
Thank you.
maybe it might not be most useful as a list, but definitely that's necessary. Although one is a negative project and the other is a positive project. And I think the negative project is absolutely useful. Whereas the positive project isn't. I also wanted to respond to a little bit more to what you had said. Sorry for your name, but in the back. It occurred to me to say a little bit more to the critique that you made. I wanted to make a clear distinction, which I probably failed at doing. Everyone obviously always talks from their own experience and their own history. And when I use a we, I wanted to make that a sort of voluntary we, that everyone who feels themselves included in that we can take something of value of it, and everyone who does it can then see the differences that are inherent in those different histories and just understand that I'm doing what everyone always does all the time, which is to talk from their own experiences and perspectives. And then when I was talking about global situations and phenomena, what I wanted to do, and maybe I didn't do a good job making a clear line between the we and the talking about the global phenomenon, was talking about was to talk about sort of power structures and acculturation processes that are being imposed on a global scale. But yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I think I really need to do more.
I'll make a bit more of the wither.
Okay, good.
I largely agree with where you end up most of your chapter sections. They're very nice conclusions. In almost all cases, I feel as though you're drawing your conclusions, or you're very free and loose with the facts and the histories that you use to construct almost all of the conclusions. I feel as though you began with your conclusions, and then you decided what story to tell to reach your conclusions. And I'm not sure what question to ask from this, but maybe just speak to the project of using why should we use facts or history if we're essentially going to use it in such a way that it isn't necessarily one that very many people would agree with.
Okay.
Especially people who care, the people who care about Marx would strongly agree that you demolished Marx. The people who have a strong opinion about Oaxaca are going to disagree with your discussion about assemblies generally. In other words, so why use...
Okay. First, on the Marx point, I chose the chapter headings specifically with the interest of being provocative, and I think there's a lot to be, useful things in the scientific method. I think there's a whole lot to be drawn from Marx, and I also do, and I also haven't read enough Marx to be able to purport to demolish him. Unfortunately, I think the people who most objected to that say have left, so my apologies. But I do think it's absolutely necessary to confront and demolish deterministic ideas of history and social change, which can or cannot be taken from Marxism. So just on that side note, although I do hate Marx and will never forgive him for the Amsterdam Congress and the First International. But as to what you said, I think I could in a very rigorously scientific way back up what I was saying at the very beginning about state formation, based on historical and ethnographic research. I also think that would probably be too boring and nerdy of a conversation for most people's taste, and it also falls outside of the specific focus of where I wanted to go. But anyone who doubts those arguments that I was making, which I was trying to make factual and what you might call objective or empirical arguments, I do feel confident that can be firmly established, and I'd be happy to do that with any anthropology group who wants to later. With regards to the other things, where I sort of pick stories, I think that there's usefulness in making empirical arguments, and I think there's also usefulness in recognizing that humans are fundamentally mythical beings, and myth is not something that we can entirely abolish or do without, nor would that even necessarily be a desirable project. And what I understand to be the most energetic attempt to do so, which would be sort of Western science, has, in the ways that it includes myth, in an invisible way has done a huge amount of damage, I think. So I think it's good to be conscientious about creating and continuing this and telling stories. History is extremely complex, and as long as on the one hand we're also cultivating the ability for critical thinking and for like evaluation of facts and absorption of criticism, at the same time it can also be useful to. I mean, our lives are basically a project of self-construction. You know, we're sort of building ourselves, deciding who we are, and that can also be. I mean, for a lot of us, that's part of our war against the state. And since there's so much history behind us, we can choose the things that empower us, or we can choose things that maybe could be literally true or something like that. But in terms of like the traditions that we come from, like does it matter? Like, how are these things handed down? You know, if we're not talking specifically about genetics, where we probably know how that's handed down, the rest of it is we basically hand down what we choose to hand down. And we recover what we choose to recover, and we forget what we choose to or what they make us forget. So I think if the myths that we tell are in flux, if they can be challenged, and if any time they make empirical statements, they can be attacked. Then I think they enunciate their advantages and minimize their disadvantages. Does that answer your question at all?
Very good answer.
Okay. Peter, you have to stop. Time is
over. Okay. So I'll be out there. Hopefully the rain will fail and we'll have sun.